This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
A busy afternoon ahead. They all are busy in many ways, Carol, because we are continually hearing from city and state leaders. It was interesting looking at the rundown of those press conferences earlier today shared by one of our producers. I shouldn't say all the states, but you know, a huge number of states, like more than half a dozen now, holding daily briefings in many cases to update their citizens.
Right, and you can hear the stress in those governors' voices in particular. Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. now have issued stay-at-home orders. Virginia's stretching to June 10th, and the San Francisco Bay Area is going to extend its mandate to May. So this is just a reminder that when we hear these deadlines or these hopes to kind of reopen our world, they're movable dates.
Yeah.
And we constantly see that. It's based on the numbers. And you continue to see the governors, even though maybe some of the new cases numbers are going down a little bit, they're still putting pressure on, you know, individuals to stay at home and keep that social distancing. So we do want to talk a little bit about what we're hearing on the medical side of this story. Andy Pakash is professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Andy joining us, of course, on the phone from Baltimore. Dr. Pakash, so nice to have you with us. You know, we were saying that you can feel that the world is working very, very hard to figure out a medical solution to this. Also, at the same time, we're seeing the medical community feeling stressed in terms of caring for those existing cases. Let's talk about that first, because we have a story on the Bloomberg that talks about doctors being threatened not to talk to the press about the situation. We hear stories about doctors having to make choices about who gets necessary medical equipment. What are you hearing on that front?
Well, I think there's a lot of stress and there's a lot of anxiety, I think. When you're particularly in cities where you're just at the beginning of the case curve, it's the unknown of how many cases are going to come in. Are the public health interventions going to work? What's the timing of the interventions that are going to work? And that affects planning, because you really don't have firm numbers to plan for. So you try to plan for the worst case scenario, hope for the best case scenario, and all of those things are just incredibly stressful on a population of people who are, let's be honest, right? These are the people that are actually going and facing these dealing with infected individuals and putting their lives on the line every day.
And so, Dr. Pakash, you know, another thing, there are so many things we want to talk to you about, but, you know, one of the other things is this notion of, you know, how this is playing out across the nation, because that speaks to the doctors, it speaks to the stress that they're feeling, but also the way individual governments are dealing with it. Help us understand kind of this variable reaction that we're seeing and maybe some of the implications of that.
Well, you know, the number of cases that are occurring can really vary based on which part of the country that you're in. And so different hospital networks are at different levels of preparation, and different hospital networks are gearing up for a surge at different times. And so what you're seeing is that there's a very sort of, I'll use the term, heterogeneous response across the nation, because it's all dictated by your local situation. For example, if you don't have a lot of cases, you probably don't want to start hoarding up too many respirators and those kind of things, because obviously there are needs in other parts of the country. Yet you have to balance that with the idea that eventually you will have a surge of cases and you want to be prepared for that.
So who ultimately should be making those decisions? Because, I mean, embedded in everything you just said, there's a lot of potential conflicts there and a lot of wrong decisions that could be made.
Yeah, so, you know, centralized decision-making is probably the best course of action. Making sure that supply line chains are there and that the movement of supplies can be done very, very quickly is a second sort of logistical thing that needs to be put in place.
What do you think at this point is the most important treatment development that folks are chasing really around the world? We're seeing a lot of coordination, certainly between the healthcare community, drug makers, and so on, researchers. But what do you think is the most important thing that is being that is happening right now that can really help us get control of this?
Well, right now the important thing is that multiple institutions are trying to set up controlled trials to actually firmly decide whether or not a treatment will or will not be beneficial. So I know here at Johns Hopkins we have a number of them going. This early stage of the surge in cases is the time when we can generate some data about what is the most effective treatment and then apply that to cases that are coming down later down the pipeline. So a number of drugs are in place. We here at Johns Hopkins have been invested in using serum from individuals who've recovered as a potential treatment for new cases. A lot of these things are now being tested, and the trials to show their efficacy are being put online, and we hope in the next couple of weeks to start seeing the results of those trials.
Dr. Pekosh, we were talking yesterday with one of the team up at Columbia that's working with David Ho, and you know him better than we do in terms of his work on AIDS research and other things. And he was talking, this doctor was talking about sort of the collaboration that is happening. Would you echo him that we're seeing a level of collaboration and maybe that's driven by a sense of urgency here? And what does that look like on the front lines where you are?
I think that is one of the most amazing things that I've been experiencing over the past few weeks. People reaching out across disciplines, reaching from the clinical into the basic science, from the basic science into the clinical, trying to find ways that each of us can contribute to this overall goal of helping to deal with infected patients coming through. My laboratory has set up a whole new wing that's devoted strictly to helping the clinical groups here in terms of assays that we can do to support them. And that's happened in the past 4 weeks. And so there's been an amazing number of discussions and conversations really with this idea that what can we do to help our patients as soon as possible? It's been fantastically inspiring.
Well, let me follow up with you on that, because it's interesting. As you were saying that, I thought about a question that we've been asking, you know, all the big important people that we talk to on this program and beyond, which is, what do you think will change on the other side of this in terms of the way you operate as a researcher, as a physician, as a member of not just a team at Johns Hopkins, but in the broader medical community? Is this the sort of thing that could change the way you do business and do your work going forward?
It's been hard to find time to think about that,
sure.
Given everything else. But honestly, I really do hope that is the case, because the conversations that we've had and the appreciation of how different people coming to the table can really contribute to overall patient management in this case has been eye-opening, I think, on both sides, both in the hospital as well as here in the research laboratories. So I really would think that this is an example of some place where all the best parts of the medical complex are being shown and can show that they're working together.
When you look around the globe, when you look around the United States, first of all, for the U.S., do you anticipate, Dr. Pekosh, that every state is going to be dealing with some level of crisis because of the virus? And secondly, when you look around the globe, are there parts of the world, whether it's some of the emerging markets, we've talked about India and Africa, certainly on our broadcast, that make you a little bit nervous and the impact that the virus could have on them?
Yeah, so I think the U.S. is really going to see, again, I'll use the term heterogeneous because I think that's the best one, even though it may be a little technical. You're going to see very different epidemics in different parts of the country, really based on how many times the virus has sort of moved into that area and how the public health measures, how effective they are and when they were implemented. So you're going to see different reports from different parts of the country. That's not in any way meant to minimize the outbreak or say that anybody's doing a better job than the other, but you're going to see different reports coming from different places about this. And absolutely, I think, we have collaborators in various parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, And I think that's a place where we're very concerned about whether there's lots of how large numbers of cases can be dealt with by the infrastructures already. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, they just controlled an epidemic of Ebola virus that's been going on for nearly 2 years. An outstanding public health effort. My guess is they're not going to have to gear up to deal with yet another viral disease, COVID-19.
Well, and Dr. Prakash, you know, when you mention that, it brings me to another point, which is this idea that this is, while there's a short-term element to this and a sense of urgency, this is also a long game in many ways, and you understand that far better than we do, given the research that you have done and given the different diseases that you have tracked. What sort of timelines do you think about in terms of, obviously, there is a health crisis, an immediate health crisis that we have to deal with. But in terms of really getting our arms around this particular disease and coping with it for a serious amount of time going forward, how should we think about that in the longer term?
Well, look to the positive examples. And there are countries there like Singapore, Hong Kong, even to some extent, Korea, that suffered a really large number of cases, but that have gotten those cases under control and are starting to really get far ahead of the virus. So those examples tell us that the virus can be controlled with good public health measures, and that's the most important thing. So I think getting this under control with the public health interventions is going to be the critical thing. Trying to send the message to individuals about changing their behaviors, even though after a few weeks, it's going to be very, very difficult to keep some of these things in place. We can get ahead of this, and there are examples out there of countries that have been able to control this and then restore some semblance of social order afterwards, or social opening up afterwards.
All right. Well, go ahead.
We're going to leave it on that note. Andy, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. Dr. Andy Prakash at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
I can safely say that as I look out my back window across my little suburb of New York City here, there are some kids playing video games. I just know that it's true. Maybe they should be on Zoom in a class. Maybe they should be doing some classwork, but they're playing video games. It's just a fact. Michael Pachter is video game technology analyst for Wedbush Securities. He joins us on the phone from Long Beach, California. I'm right, Michael, right? I mean, a lot of kids are playing video games. A lot of adults are playing video games right now.
Yeah, I just took a break for playing video games since this call. So, yes, everybody's playing
games. I think you call that research, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. That's literally your job.
It is, absolutely.
So what do we know about the backdrop here? I mean, there's anecdotal evidence, but, I mean, you've got your hands on real data here, right?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, realistically, there's two things we're going to do whether we're indoors or outdoors. We're going to eat and we're going to entertain ourselves. And, you know, it's intuitively obvious if we can't go to restaurants, we'll eat at home. If we can't go out to movie theaters and sporting events or even engage in physical activity, we're going to do that at home. And so, you know, clearly we're seeing from internet service providers that internet usage is up. Verizon said up 75%. We got something yesterday from Comcast talking about Wi-Fi access. And so the question is just, what are people doing with the internet? And the answer is, obviously, they're watching a lot of video and they're playing a lot of games. I mean, Spotify just said their usage is up. People are just entertaining themselves in place. Games are the most likely, you know, beneficiary of this. You can do it on mobile, you can do it on tablets, you can do it on your TV, and people are doing that.
So are the supplies there to meet the demand? The Telegraph had a report that whether it's the UK or the US, there's definitely, you know, people are out there doing, you know, and playing video games. It's a great escape right now, especially those who are, you know, feeling isolated from the rest of the world or from others. And the thing is, the demand, some of the consoles are completely sold out. So I'm just curious about supply.
Yeah, Nintendo Switch is the one that's impossible to get. And, you know, obviously they didn't plan for a pandemic, but they launched a game called Animal Crossing, which is actually pretty much a single-player game. Really fun, though. It's like a life simulation. You farm and you trade, and it's a really, really fun game. So that sales of that game are off the charts, and people are trying to get their hands on Switches. And I frankly think that's because there's a big demand for kids. Adults probably can play on PC or phone, or they have consoles. You're not seeing Xboxes and PlayStations sold out, though. So the Switch is really benefiting just because it's, you know, the hot item right now, and they have the hot game.
Well, it's also interesting, you know, you mentioned PCs, because a lot of people, and I think Carol and I are both in this category, not the gamer category, but more the... A lot of folks are sort of amping up their work from home sort of setups. I mean, I know we boosted our internet speed just to deal not only with my needs broadcasting this show, but also in anticipation of more streaming and other things that the kids are doing with their schoolwork and things like that. So I do wonder how that plays through, especially the PC gaming part of the equation.
PC gamers total about 400 million people total, and that's a lot. Console gamers more like 250 million.
Interesting.
Mobile gamers 1.5 billion. So, you know, the most frequently used device is a mobile phone, mm-hmm. And you can play games like Candy Crush on your tablet as well. PC, you know, the dominant games are games like Fortnite, League of Legends, you know, so those are games that people play all the time. Console tends to be things like Madden and FIFA and Call of Duty. So, you know, different types of experiences. And I think the right analogy is like going to a movie theater to see a feature-length film. You know, that's what a console game is. And watching a YouTube video is what a mobile game is like. So, you know, they're different types of activity for different types of devices, but all really engaging, and, you know, people play them all day long.
Is it too early, though, to make some investment calls based on what's happening now? Does it make any sense to even think about that at this point, Michael?
I mean, beyond the pandemic. I mean, the pandemic is clearly going to drive up the use case for, you know, the month of March and probably for the entire June quarter. You'll probably see some people won over permanently. So you're going to get some people who weren't really gamers before who find that, you know, this activity is really enjoyable. I actually think that we're on the verge of expanding the market just remarkably by streaming games. And that's, you know, Google's offering something called Stadia. I think Amazon's going to enter the fray. Microsoft and Sony each have products that allow you to play games on any device without a console or a PC. When that happens, and I think that starts this fall, and I think it grows over the next 5 to 7 years, it should double or triple demand for the content. So anybody who's got content is a beneficiary. Anybody who makes peripherals, you know, controllers or keyboards, is a beneficiary. And, you know, we're working with an ETF called Gamer, GAMR, that's 90 some odd stocks in the video game and video game technology sector. That's the pure play. That's the easiest way to play it. You're going to get exposure across border, across industries, to a demographic that's going to expand a lot.
Right. Embracer, you've got Zynga, you've got Glu Mobile, you've got all of the names in there.
Well, because also
pretty much everybody, other than, you know, big companies like Google, where gaming is not a big piece of their business, but will be someday. Amazon, same thing. But short of that, yes, you've got all the publishers, all the device makers, all the pure play mobile guys.
Well, and even, I believe, and keep me honest here, Michael, some of the semiconductor companies too. When we talk about that with our inside our internal research analysts all the time, about how when you look at the NVIDIAs and others of the world, so much demand, it seems, these days, and I guess this was both on the PC and the console side, is especially, you know, there's some semiconductor demand that is driven by gaming, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, NVIDIA in particular, they make the high-end graphics cards, so, you know, that 400 million PC gamers, they need NVIDIA cards. The 250 million console players, they need NVIDIA cards.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Great context. And, you know, one of those things that totally makes sense when you think about how people are acting during this very unusual period. Michael Pachter is video game technology analyst for Wedbush Securities, joining us on the phone from Long Beach, California. Karen.
I just think of it was mid-March when we heard E3, the video game conference, was canceled because of coronavirus fears. And it made me, you know, that was one of the things, along with the sports events, when all of these things started being canceled, because that's a huge event, so crucial to the industry, but just a reminder of the lockdown that we would soon all be facing as the world, and certainly the nation as we know it, was shutting down.
Seems like 100 years ago.
It does. That's why I had to look back, and it was March 11th.
Good Lord. All right. I'm driving in my car.
I turn on the radio. Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no. Who's going to drive you home? Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's check in for the Drive to the Close with our old pal Alan Zafran, founding partner and co-CEO of IEQ Capital, joining us on the phone from Foster City, California. Well, Alan, the last time we talked to you was a very different time, and I do wonder, in the interim, what's been going on? How are you feeling? How's your family doing? What's it like in your neighborhood, in your town?
Jason, we're home sheltering. I got to tell you, we're living it's kind of interesting because what you watch on television, what you hear is absolutely terrible. But you're sitting in your home, you're with your family. When this is all said and done, it's a horrible health crisis. It's a horrible economic event. In the eyes of an eight-year-old, playing board games and having family meals at home, as long as they're safe, here in an affluent area like Foster City, might be the best time of their life. So that's the silver lining on what's clearly a dark cloud. But I can tell you, people are anxious.
Yeah.
And this event, Jason, is so different in, I think, about 2008, because it's personal. It's personal. It's affecting everybody directly, and people know people who are being adversely impacted health-wise, too. That's what makes this one really difficult.
Well, and you know, it's funny, or not so funny, but you know, we've been having discussions about the longer-lasting impact of the virus, and I do wonder whether it's in, you know, telemedicine, or whether it's online learning, or I don't know, even, you know, a lot of us are working from home. I do wonder, or about the social nets and safety nets that are not part of our society. Alan, I do wonder about the longer lasting impact, and I'm just curious if you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, we're going to learn that redundancy is important. We're going to learn the importance of capital expenditures, both from a healthcare perspective as well as from a technology perspective. I pity the business soul who thought his internet was going to work well when he got home and realized it wasn't running at the same speed as the office. We're going to be far more attentive to the need to not allow a pandemic like this happen again. Now, whether we have the political willpower and the economic ability to put in place those things we need to do to build up the infrastructure to deal with a pandemic in the future, we will see. But in the moment, it seems like that's going to be something that's going to be done. What you're going to see, too, is in the financial markets, it's already playing that way, obviously, the way some stocks are working. But you're going to see pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies are going to garner greater interest from the investment community. Clearly, large cap, balance sheet, strong balance sheet tech companies are going to be well positioned, because we're just going to continue to see, all things equal, certainly until this virus seems like it's safe to get past it, you're going to see more of a domestic focus, more of an inward focus, to make sure that everyone's got their own personal safety net as well as a business having its safety net. That's kind of the big theme in the short run.
Well, and that safety net point is so interesting to Alan. And, you know, we're going to talk in just a little while with Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, as you know. And, you know, he's going to make a pretty strong argument, I believe, against, you know, sort of propping up a lot of companies. You know, call it a bailout, call it what you want. But part of this rainy day point, I think, is really important, to the extent that a lot of the criticism that's been leveled against companies, whether they're in the airline industry or elsewhere, is, listen, they spent this money on buybacks. They spent this money in ways that weren't essentially saving for a rainy day. Now, this is beyond a rainy day, of course, and yet I do wonder whether that behavior will change, or whether, given this stimulus is sweeping in, whether companies will be like, "No, that's cool. They'll help me out if I need it."
You're touching on a really important point. Unfortunately, our stock market's built on quarterly profits.
Yeah.
And so we have a mismatch. Businesses should be run for the long run. Stocks should be bought for the long run. And yet we play this game matching how a company's performing every 90 days. And did it match the earnings estimates? And unless we're going to restructure the way in which we calibrate and measure public company performance, I don't think you're going to see a change ultimately in corporate behavior. Buybacks are just another way to prop up earnings per share. I do think it is probably well-suited if the government's going to bail out a business, they should put in place measures to ensure that the businesses are there to support other constituents like employees and customers as much as the executives. So I understand why they would do that. They have to make sure that they can still create a compensation system that attracts competent, efficient, effective managers to run those businesses properly. That's the other side of the coin. If you don't allow those businesses to be running by people who are compensated enough for the hard work they do, you're going to create a business that doesn't operate efficiently or well, and that will also have a longer-term negative economic impact. So it's complicated. There's multiple sides to every issue.
No, yeah, it is complicated. But I do wonder, and again, you know, Robert Reich is going to bring up this point, but, you know, Alan, as you know, I mean, when you think about influence in Washington, it's not the individual walking down the street. It's the large and deep pockets of corporations and, you know, their lobbying groups. And so you do wonder whether when we do have these stimulus packages that are drafted, you know, that they definitely sway and lean, you know, on the sides of often big publicly held companies.
I don't disagree. And the optics look terrible politically. On the other hand, I think there is an argument.
But it's not just optics, right? It's really actions that are actually taken.
Yeah. And the counter argument would be, we'll pick on the airlines. In the absence of a bailout of the airline industry, I'm not sure that they could survive, which gets back to the point, why were they buying back shares? But if you've built your business with ample amount of debt and you have a cyclical business, you're going to go out of business, at which point you're going to have a much greater cost to society. So we may be right. We shouldn't bail out the executives and the airlines. The problem is we've got a lot of people who are now on unemployment insurance, and it's hard to retrain them and find them new jobs. You can't win either way. So you've got to find a middle ground. But really, the emphasis, I think, is to the degree if you're going to be punitive and eliminate various industries, the economic damage could be significantly greater than we realize. We could have a sustainably high unemployment rate. We'd be running large deficits to support millions upon millions of people. We'd impair our ability to borrow effectively and would actually create havoc for the financial system. So as bad or onerous or painful as it may feel to bail out some of these industries, some of them are so significant to the economy. In the absence of doing something to prop them up and support them, it would cause a much greater longer-term economic damage that it would take much longer to work through.
Right. All right. Unfortunately, we're going to leave it there. I feel like we're just getting warmed up. Alan Zafran, you're going to have to come back and hang out with us virtually. And, you know, maybe before too long, you'll be visiting us in New York or we'll be out west. Thank you so much. Founding partner, co-CEO of IEQ Capital, on the phone from Foster City, California. Thoughtful, as always.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.